Okay, let me begin by asking if anyone has any questions from last time or the readings. And I see this is coming through. It doesn't look as sharp as it should. And this is a new computer I got, so there are probably some adjustments that need to be made. Anyone have any suggestions about how to improve the clarity of the typeface? It's an XP machine. Okay, can you see it in the back, Mr. Underwood, Mr. Cunningham?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So, any questions on where we left off? I know we had just started getting into the uniformity of profit principle. And, all right, I'll just recapitulate the highlights of that. There is this major principle in economics, possibly the most important single principle of price theory, in my judgment, and that is that there prevails a tendency toward an equalization of the rate of return on capital, in all branches of the economic system. A tendency toward an equalization of the rate of return on capital in all branches of the economic system. And we're talking about the rate of return on capital, not a profit margin. A profit margin is profit as a percentage of sales. The rate of return on capital, or rate of profit, those are equivalent expressions. That's profit as a percentage of the capital invested. And I pointed out that you can have permanently unequal profit margins with an equal rate of profit, and the unequal profit margins translate into an equal rate of profit depending on the capital turnover ratio. There are some industries where the capital turnover ratio is much higher than others. For example, supermarkets typically earn 2% on sales or thereabouts, but that doesn't mean that supermarkets are less profitable than automobile production, where they might earn 10% or so on sales, or that automobile production is less profitable than electric power generation, where they perhaps might earn 20% on sales. What operates to equalize the rates of profit is differences in the capital turnover ratio, which is the ratio of sales to capital. So in a supermarket, if their sales are five times the capital invested and they're earning 2% on sales, that's five times that 2%, that's 10% on capital. If in the automobile industry they're earning 10% on sales, but their sales merely equal their capital, well then they're earning only 10% on their capital. In electric power production, if they're earning 20% on sales, but their annual sales are only half of their capital invested, well then they're earning 10% also. And what's governing capital turnover ratios is essentially the technological characteristics of the industry. In supermarkets, a significant part of the capital turns over every day or within a few days, but in automobiles and still less electric power production, the turnover is not so rapid. Now, we explained why this principle works, starting from the existence of unequal rates of profit at any given time. Rates of profit are unequal. There are constantly factors at work in the economy, churning up the system, making them unequal. Everything you might recall as to what causes demand changes, anything that is causing demand changes to go on in the economy, such as any one product anywhere getting cheaper and people having money freed up to buy more of other products, that operates to bring about wide-ranging demand increases. Anytime there is something which makes a necessity more expensive, that will bring about wide-ranging demand decreases, and there'll be corresponding effects on profit margins and rates of profit throughout the economic system. and then all of the relations between substitutes and complements that we went into, things of this kind, these are constantly churning up rates of profit. But if the process of changes were to stop, if things were to go on unchanged in their fundamental aspects for some period of time, then the rate of return on capital would indeed actually operate to equalize. Because starting from unequal rates, well, we know that people prefer higher rates to lower rates. They prefer positive rates to negative rates. And so in the face of certain investments that are losing money, others that are making money, some that are making relatively little money, others that are making substantial money, where will people wish to invest their capitals? In the higher returns, the highest rates possible, other things equal. And so capital gets withdrawn from loss-making or low-profit industries and invested in the higher-profit industries. And what is the very consequence of that movement? What's the effect of the reduction in capital invested in those industries which were initially taking losses or earning only very low rates of profit? What's the effect of the withdrawal of capital from those industries on their ability to produce, their selling prices, profit margins, and rate of profit? That will increase. So the loss, the negative and low rates of return in response to a withdrawal of capital, which is caused by the losses or low rates of return, the very consequence of losses or low rates of return is to cause capital to be withdrawn, the further effect of which is that production, supply, decrease, price, profit margin, and the rate of profit in such industries rise. While conversely, in those industries that were initially exceptionally profitable, well, there we have additional capital investment. The high rate of profit is an incentive to the investment of capital, just as the low rate or loss was an incentive to the withdrawal of capital. And the high rate of profit itself is a source of additional capital. How is that? A reinvestment of the profits. And now, what is the effect of the expansion, the greater investment in those industries with an above average rate of return? What's the effect on their production and supply? Okay, their supply will increase, and the what will happen to their price and profit margin? Okay, that will go down, and the rate of profit will go down. Okay, so those high rates are in process of coming down, while the low rates are in process of coming up. And just as the high rate of profit was both an incentive and a means for the expansion of such industries, low rates of profit are not only the incentive for the withdrawal of capital, but low rates of profit and certainly losses directly slice away capital. Losses, obviously, are losses of capital invested, and low rates of profit can themselves automatically be accompanied by reductions in capital invested if the rates are so low that they fail to cover whatever dividends may be paid. So if you're earning a very low rate but paying a dividend at a higher rate, that means capital withdrawal too. So we have the basic fact. We start off, some industries are earning very high rates of profit, others low or negative rates, and capital will move from the low profit or loss-making industries into the high profit industries with the effect of the rate of profit coming down in the high profit industries and coming up in the low profit industries. Now, if we reach this point, say, where the disparity is not as great as it used to be, but there is still some disparity, what will be the effect of any continuing disparity? There'll be more movement. And what is the only logical stopping point of movement in response to inequalities? When will movement stop? When the rates of return become equal. That's the basis of the principle. And this principle goes back at least as far as Adam Smith. It has been propounded in in economics books generation after generation. You might find it lost in the shuffle in a text like Samuelson, but it's a very major principle, and it sheds a lot of light on things. And here we can turn to its significance. It is responsible for achieving a reasonable, harmonious balancing of the different branches of industry. Everyone has a legal right to invest in any line of industry he wants to. And if you knew nothing about economics, which is the unfortunate state of many, many people, it might appear entirely reasonable that perhaps everyone would plow into a few industries and others would be utterly unprovided for. Well, we have a basis of showing why that doesn't happen, or why anytime things are working in that direction, the process will be stopped and reversed. Well, what's the effect of too much capital being invested in some lines and not enough in other lines? What happens as we have excessive investment in some branches of the economy and not enough investment in other branches? Yes, Ms. Cox? I'm sorry, Ms. Fox?
The area that you are heavily investing, your rate of profit is going to decrease. While that's decreasing, the lines that don't have a lot of capital will start to increase, and they'll get more.
Okay, so if we have too much investment in certain lines, the effect will be a low rate of profit, and if it's really a lot of investment, losses. To the degree that we have inadequate investment in other lines, what's the effect on the rate of profit there? It goes up. So the very consequence of making mistakes in the relative overinvestment and overproduction in certain industries and relative underinvestment and relative underproduction in other industries, the very consequence of such mistakes is low profits or losses in the cases in which there has been the mistake of relative overinvestment and overproduction, which obviously puts a stop to the further overexpansion of those industries and will operate to reverse it. And the premium profits in the industries with inadequate investment, well, that creates an incentive and also provides the means for stepped up investment. So it's in this way that the mistakes made in the relative levels of investment in different industries are self-correcting. They produce consequences, the effect of which is to throw things in reverse. And it's precisely for this kind of reason that people often talk about the automatic mechanism of the market, compare it to an automatic governor on a machine, a thermostat on a boiler. You know, a boiler may heat the temperature in a room too hot. That expands some piece of metal, which then shuts the boiler off. If the temperature cools down too much, the piece of metal contracts, turns the boiler back on. If a machine is going too fast, there can be an automatic governor on it that slows it down. If it's not fast enough, the same gizmo speeds it up. And the uniformity of profit principle is very analogous to that. Yes, Mr. Levy.
Is the reason for this because the profits are being distributed against a smaller base of investors?
Is the reason that the profits are being distributed against a smaller base of investors? No, I don't think so. It's the there's too little capital relative to the demand. So if we have too little capital, too little supply of the item relative to the demand, that results in a premium price, a premium profit margin, a premium rate of profit. And by the same token, if we have too much investment, too much production, we'll have a temporarily low price, a lower negative profit margin, lower negative rate of profit.
Could I ask for an example? I feel like a perfect example would have been like the bubble.
Okay, the bubble, we certainly had a relative overexpansion in telecommunications equipment. And I read that there was some telecommunications equipment selling for 10 cents on the dollar compared to what had been paid to buy it. Now, that is an example of relative overinvestment. That industry went way too far. That would not be among the usual or ordinary mistakes that would be made. The market left on its own would be very unlikely to carry things that far. In the bubble, and in all bubbles, there's another phenomenon going on that creates the artificial appearance of more capital available to invest than is actually available. You have the expansion of the money supply, lending it out in the form, introducing it into the economy in the form of new loans to business. So the appearance is created of more capital being around than is in fact there. And so undertakings are begun for which the actual supply of capital is not sufficient. And that's where the relative overinvestment occurs. And this is greatly exacerbated to the extent that new and additional money is going into the stock market and driving up stock prices. If you think of the extent to which people calculate their wealth on the basis of the value of their stocks, well, a bubble in the stock market creates the delusion of more capital throughout the economy and can result in really gross disproportionate investment.
What about the opposite example? I remember at one point in the bubble listening to a radio show about, I think it was Procter & Gamble's valuation, how all the capital that was invested in P&G stock and traditionally holding steady, it decreased because it all flew over the technology stock. And the argument was that the demand for soap did not change.
Are you saying that Procter & Gamble stock decreased in the bubble?
In the bubble.
Well, I'm not familiar with that. That would be highly unusual. Very few stocks were decreasing in the bubble unless they had some really special problem. So I don't know what the story of Procter & Gamble
was. The idea was that the capital was flight from traditional to high tech.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to associate that with this.
Well, it's conceivable. I mean, people are thinking high tech is going to be so profitable, and here's Procter & Gamble in a stodgy old industry, so let's invest all the more heavily. Well, then that would qualify. Yes, Mr. Severn.
Just to add to that, in the industry, we had many retirees abandon value-type stocks, and on average, you have these funds that were very consistent over time. They weren't down a lot, but they were down, 1 to 5% that year, in 1999, when growth stocks had taken off. Uh-huh. So there was that little shift, although it was temporal.
Okay, because there were people who were saying, well, I got to get in on the action.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. So they abandoned what has treated them well over the years.
Yeah.
Went over here and bought lottery tickets. Basically.
Okay, yeah. All right, well, to that extent, you'd have not only this relative overexpansion, but possibly some withdrawal of capital from some of the industries. Okay, so I want to make you aware of the fact that mistakes of relative overinvestment and overproduction, relative underinvestment and underproduction in a free market are self-correcting. They're self-correcting. And the same applies in cases in which an industry is extraordinarily profitable for a time. Well, what's the effect of its extraordinary profitability on investment in that industry? Pardon me?
The investment's going to
increase
with a greater
profit. Okay, there'll be a stepped-up investment, and that will operate to bring down that high rate of profit. So this is why you can read stories every so often. The profits in this or that industry are absolutely outrageous. The government should come in and do something. Well, if the government does nothing, the market will take care of it, because the very height of the extreme profit will provide the incentive and means for stepped-up investment. Yes, Mr. Underwood.
Does that apply even if the business is if new technology is continually being brought in?
Okay, that's a very good question. What about continuing new technology? I'd like to postpone that for a few minutes, because I intend to deal with that under number 3. The need of businessmen to introduce continuous improvements in production, and that, I think, is the best place to address that. Yes, Kumar.
You said something about the market character itself in a free economy.
Yeah.
What about socialist economy, that the government intervenes and does something?
All right. Are you asking what is the case with a socialist economy? Because I've said only a free market. Well, in a free market, you have the incentive of profit to bring about stepped up investment, and you have the incentive of loss or low profit to withdraw capital. Now, in socialism, does any individual official lose any of his personal wealth? Or even in our economy, insofar as the government is involved in running anything, if a government enterprise takes a loss, like imagine the post office takes a loss, does the postmaster general, or whatever the title of the individual now is, or any member of the congressional committees overseeing the post office, do they lose any of their wealth?
No.
So does anyone anywhere have a personal financial incentive to stem losses of government enterprises?
No.
And if something were to be profitable, is any government official legally allowed personally to profit from it?
No.
So what do you think is the government's response to any mistakes it might make of insufficiently doing something or excessively doing something? Should we expect there to be any kind of automated or automatic corrective mechanism?
They'll probably want to just not draw attention to it.
But I mean,
they probably just wouldn't want to draw attention to it.
Well, they have no incentive to really move. So you can't expect that the same kinds of response will apply. This is a very, very important matter. The whole price system does not really apply to socialism because of the absence of profit and loss motivation, plus no possibility, if you have a whole socialist system, no possibility of competition. Okay, so now also you should realize that the bigger the mistakes, the harder they are to make, because if you have a modest mistake, all right, that means a modest reduction or increase in the rate of profit. A bigger mistake means a greater reduction or increase. So you're leaning against more powerful counteracting forces of correction. So it's very, very difficult for a mistake of overinvestment and overproduction in normal circumstances, unless fanned by credit expansion, this process of creating new money, introducing it in the economy in the form of new loans, unless fanned by that sort of development, the size of mistakes will typically not be very great. And the very fact that people want to make profitable investments, and more profitable rather than less profitable, and they want to avoid losses, that leads them to try to avoid, in the very first place, stay out of any kinds of investments in which there appears to be overinvestment and overproduction, or that have such a prospect. Rectify anyone else's mistakes of underinvestment and underproduction. Jump in to where the returns are expected to be highest. So this operates to hold down the number of such mistakes, because people are exercising forethought of a kind that operates to minimize the mistakes in the first place. And this is reinforced by the fact that at any given time, most of the capital in the economy will be in the possession of people who have avoided the mistake of overinvestment and overproduction, and have done reasonably well in rectifying others' mistakes of underinvestment and underproduction. Let me say a little bit about this second point, the power of the consumers to shift the course of production. Consumer sovereignty. Point two. Now, imagine that we had a uniform rate of profit having been realized, and now some change occurs. For whatever reason, the consumers decide they want more of some products, less of other products. An example, in recent years, people changed their diet patterns. A few years ago, lots of people were switching out of fatty foods, foods they thought had high cholesterol, and so that was red meat, and into things like chicken and fish. Okay, if we started out with the cattle industry having a comparable rate of profit to chicken raising and fish farming and fishing, what's the effect of large numbers of consumers deciding they want to change their diet plan on the rates of profit in these industries?
Beef industry will go down.
Pardon me?
So the beef industry.
Okay, the rate of profit in beef goes down. The rate of profit in chicken and fish goes up. Okay, now what is the further effect in response to these changes in the relative rates of profit? What would be the effect on investment in beef production? That will go down. Capital will be withdrawn from beef production. An additional capital will be invested in raising chickens and fish. And so what's going to be the effect on the rates of profit in these industries? Okay, cattle will be coming back up. Chicken and fish will be going back down. So we've had a change in the pattern of demand, which initially operates to reduce the profits where demand has fallen, increase the rate of profit where demand has risen. But then in response to this change in the pattern of demand, there is a change in the state of capital investment. Less capital is invested in the lines where the consumers want less. More capital is invested in the lines where consumers want more. And this would go on until, again, the rate of profit were equalized. Well, what would be different after the rate of profit were equalized again? What would be different compared to the way things were at the very beginning? We started out, beef production was at a certain level, fish and chicken production was at a certain level, and now the demand for the one has fallen, the demand for the other has increased. So what's going to be different?
The ratio of investment between the two industries.
Okay, when you say the ratio of investment, you mean the amount of capital invested?
The amount of capital would be less than the beef and more.
Okay, so what's going to be the effect on the size of the industries? What's going to be the effect after the dust has settled and the rates of profit are once again comparable? What's going to be the effect on the size of the beef industry compared to what it was before, and the size of chicken and fish raising compared to what they were before?
Chicken will have shrunk.
Pardon me?
The beef industry will.
Okay, beef will have shrunk and chicken and fish will have expanded. So the permanent effect of this change in the pattern of consumer demand is a change in the relative size of the industries. Notice the consumers have it in their power and regularly exercise that power to change the relative size of the various industries in the economy simply by changing their pattern of spending. Wherever the consumers want more, the immediate effect will be to make such industries more profitable. Where they want less, the immediate effect is to make such industries less profitable. The further effect is stepped up investment in the industries where the consumers wanted more, diminished investment in the industries where they wanted less, and the economy is readjusted, repatterned to fit the change in consumer demand. What if the consumers decided they didn't want to buy anything any longer of a certain industry? Like suppose everybody decided to quit smoking. Then what would happen to the tobacco industry? How much capital would remain invested in tobacco and cigarette production?
It would diminish at the rate of what their profits were, because if their profits are shrinking, then their own source of capital would shrink.
Okay, so capital certainly would be shrinking. Now, you see, it's one thing if, let's say we started out, half the adult population smoked, and we had a cigarette industry geared to producing for half the population, and now it falls to 40% of the adult population smokes. That would cut the rate of profit, make the tobacco industry smaller than it was. But suppose it continues on down. It's 30%, 20%, 10%, zero. Then what is left of the tobacco industry?
Nothing.
It's gone. So if there's something that the consumers just don't want, it cannot remain in existence. Anyone producing it will find he's producing something that he can't sell or can't sell at a profit. So they'll stop. Now, typically, we don't take an industry all the way to the point of extermination, but that would happen if there just were no customers. If there's to be any industry of a certain type, it's necessary that there be enough customers to cover the full costs of whatever size of the industry remains, plus provide a competitive rate of profit, as good a rate of profit as can be earned in other lines of investment. And if that's not the case, the industry heads for extinction.
Does it only work in legal industries?
Does it only work in legal industries? You suspect maybe not in illegal industries.
How would
It would work in industries that both legal and illegal. Let's apply it to narcotics. Suppose people decided that narcotics was really self-destructive and they weren't going to use them.
Well, no, I'm saying just when we're talking about government intervention, I'm just saying it's, if it became legal, narcotics, for example, would that decrease the return on investment?
Okay. Oh, I see what you mean.
I'm sorry, I didn't clarify.
All right. Right now, in the narcotics industry, for those who can get away with it, there's a premium rate of profit. You risk going away to jail for a long period. You also risk being killed by rival dealers. So there are high risks associated with it. Now, let's imagine the prevailing rate of profit in the economy is about 10%, or whatever. Do you think anyone would say, wow, if I can make 11% dealing narcotics, that's for me? I don't think so. So this, where there is an unusual degree of risk, social opprobrium, in such a case, there can be a premium rate of profit to compensate for these negative elements. So
never even out in that case.
In that case, there would tend to be a premium compensating for the extra degree of risk, social opprobrium, any kind of negative. By the same token, there can be instances where the rate of return might be somewhat lower, like if you have an extra secure type of investment, there the rate of return can be somewhat lower. So this tendency toward equalization of rates of return applies, other things being equal, the degree of risk, social opprobrium, whatever. Yes, Mr. Trexler.
You mentioned that the consumer can exercise power to change the size of the industry.
Yeah.
Don't you think that could also happen if there's underinvestment in an industry because yes, the rate of profit would put equilibrium with other industries, but you would probably see a shrinkage in possibly that industry because, well, maybe just that consumers, because people would maybe substitute another product, another industry. So that underinvestment would cause some shrinkage in itself.
I think you're referring to the fact that if there is a relative underinvestment, underproduction, the price of the product will be at a premium, and in response to the premium price, there'll be a reduction in quantity demanded along the given demand curve.
I guess I was thinking along the lines, if there's a shortage in supply, then you're going to have consumers move to another product.
Yeah, now I think that's the very kind of situation I was naming. Let's suppose we have some part of oil production is knocked out by terrorists. So we have a reduced supply of oil. The price of oil will go up. In response to the higher price of oil, what will happen to the quantity demanded?
It'll go down.
Okay. Now, that is not something making the production of oil less profitable. It's simply an adjustment to the reduced supply and higher price. What would equalize the rate of return would now be, here is oil production, which has gotten more profitable. So what incentive should that provide, and what means should it provide? It should provide an incentive and means to step up oil production. Now, let's imagine we had a very extreme case. Suppose there was no possibility of increasing the production of something. Such a case was developed a couple of hundred years ago by David Ricardo. He cited the case of wines of a special quality grown from grapes, produced from grapes that can only be grown on a soil of very limited extent. So suppose there's a certain flavor of wine. It requires grapes of a kind that have to be grown at a certain elevation with a certain temperature, a certain wind, etc., etc. And there's only 1,000 acres in the world that qualify for this. And we're producing as much as we possibly can. And the price of this wine might be very, very high, a couple hundred bucks a bottle, perhaps. Can anyone figure out how the tendency toward a uniform rate of profit would apply in a case of this kind? Just think, what is it that limits the ability to produce these special grapes?
Well, doesn't this have to do with elasticity of demand?
Well, let's say the demand is inelastic, whatever, and there's a price that is setting the wine high enough to limit the quantity demanded to the limited supply that can be produced. And so it costs you only so much in wages and materials and equipment to produce the grapes, to make the wine. What is the limiting element in production?
The capacity.
What element? What part of the capacity? What? The land. It's the land of very limited extent. All right, what do you think would be the effect on the price of such land if this land can yield a product of exceptionally high value, and it's the key limiting element, and you have a product that is much more valuable than the ordinary costs of production, the labor costs, the equipment costs, chemical fertilizers, whatever. Imagine that if you just calculated the capital invested in the casks in which you age the wine, the capital that needs to be invested in paying the wine growers, the capital that needs to be invested in any kind of processing operation. Suppose the rate of return calculated on that part of the capital alone, imagine that were 40 or 50%. That would be a huge rate of return. And here you are, if you will provide the capital, that amount of capital, and plus you can get hold of the land, you'll make this high rate of return. How would this affect what would be paid for the land? The land would go to such a premium, the price of the land would go so high that when you when you added in its value as part of the capital invested, you'd have the uniform rate of profit again. So even when you can't expand production at all, whatever it is that is limiting the output, that will acquire premium capitalized value such that the extra profit will yield only the going rate of return on this enlarged capital base. You can see an example of the same principle. Is anyone familiar with the New York City taxicab industry? Pardon me? Yes, you need a medallion affixed to the hood of the cab. Now, a new cab, what, may cost $20,000, $25,000, whatever. You don't have to be a genius to drive a cab. But in order to drive a cab legally and pick up passengers for hire while cruising the streets, it's required that you have one of these medallions. And the City Council of New York essentially stopped issuing them or froze their number at about 12,000 back in 1938. It was a little under 12,000. A few years ago, they added a few hundred, so it's still limited around 12,000. And the last time I heard, the price of one of these medallions was over $200,000. Now, why do you think anyone would pay $200,000 for a taxicab medallion?
That's the reason why you would buy a franchise.
Well, similar, but...
It represents future streams.
Pardon me?
It represents future streams.
Yes, it's the capitalized value of a premium future income. And what creates that premium future income? The limitation, the license. So you're willing to pay a premium, and when you calculate the premium, then the rate of profit in operating a New York City taxi cab is not so high relative to anything else. So where you have a limiting element on the supply side, and the production and supply just can't be expanded, then a sufficiently high value will end up being attached to that limiting element, so that that high value will bring the rate of return down toward the general level. Yes, Mr. Timotek.
I just fixed that uniform. You were talking about the grapes of the land. If you own that land,
yeah.
I mean, I understand how the principle worked. If there was just this land that could be used, that you know that the people that want to work in that industry want to purchase this land.
Yeah.
But if you own that land, your profit's not limited by that part of your capital. I mean, that fixed asset's never gonna. If you're looking from a profit standpoint, isn't gonna increase, correct?
Wait, here you are, let's say you own some land.
Right.
Okay, and maybe this has been in your family for generations. Okay, and you personally are just incurring relatively minor costs of production, and you're selling your product at an enormous price. So if we calculated your capital as only what has been invested in your agricultural equipment, your payroll, etc., then your rate of profit would appear to be stupendously high. When we say there is this tendency toward a uniform rate of return, we have to allow for the market value of the land. That market value of such land, as the ownership of which is the precondition to earning this huge profit, it would have a very high market value. And the rate of return calculated on that basis is what would be tending toward uniformity.
So you have to take into account the market value. It refers to
the market value. Yeah.
The fair market value.
Yeah. Okay. Now, if you had someone, let's say there's some present day cab driver, whose grandfather was a cab driver too, and he got his medallion or great grandfather in 1938 for $10 or whatever, and it's been passed down generation to generation. Maybe his book value of the medallion is $10, and he's earning the premium income corresponding to $200,000 of additional investment. It might look like he's earning a very high rate of profit, but we'd have to bring in the market value of the medallion. Okay, well, this point about the power of the consumers to shift the course of production, and it's consumer buying patterns that determine the relative size of all the different industries. Why, for example, is the automobile industry so much larger than the book publishing industry? Does that have anything to do with the way people are spending their money? That people are spending a lot more of their funds in buying automobiles than books, and that's what brings about a much heavier capital investment in the auto industry. Now, the kinds of products produced, that reflects consumer demand. Why is it that some part of the publishing industry is bringing out new editions of old classics like Shakespeare and whoever, and another part is bringing out pornography? What does that have to do with the pattern of consumer demand? They're acting in accordance with the demand. Now, if there's something that they publish that the public decides it doesn't want to buy, then what will happen to the continued publication of such material? It'll cease because it won't be profitable. And the same thing applies to breakfast cereals. I believe there have been congressional hearings where executives of the breakfast cereal companies are grilled by congressmen. Why are you producing these cereals with a high sugar content? Don't you care about the cavities of the children and all? Well, it's hard to avoid the impression that business firms get some kind of perverse pleasure out of producing unhealthful products, salacious literature, that they're getting their kicks from harming the public in one way or another. Well, why do you think they produce sweet cereals rather than supposedly nutritious ones that don't taste particularly good? Because they want to sell them. If the children sitting in there at the table or whatever, if they were knocking over the bowls of sweet cereal and saying, this is disgusting junk, and insisting on porridge or whatever, what do you think would be the effect on the kinds of products the breakfast cereal companies produce? Then they produce porridge. They're driven by demand. It's not the case that they somehow decide they want to produce some bad set of products and then they manipulate people into buying them. Now, you see, it's amazing. The congressmen can concentrate their ire on the business executives, but the business executives are really just carrying out the will of the buying public. And these congressmen are in a position, really, of overriding implicitly the will of the consumers. They make it appear that they're overriding the will of some vicious capitalist pig executives, but what they're really doing is attempting to overturn the choice of the consumers. Now, let me turn to point three, which will connect. I think it was either Mr. Underwood or Mr. Trexler raised a question earlier about technology. And notice we have this principle of the tendency toward a uniform rate of profit. We certainly don't observe a uniform rate of profit at any given time. Rates of profit are very unequal when we look across the entire economy. It's just a tendency. And one of the things that works to keep the rate of profit non-uniform is innovation. That's the major factor, I think, that maintains inequalities in the rate of profit, continuing innovation. And I refer here to the need of businessmen to introduce continuous improvements in production and do it ahead of their rivals. And let's just look at this. Suppose one firm introduces some improvement in its product. We can use the automobile industry. There was a time early in the 20th century when automobiles had to be started using a hand crank. I'm sure you've all seen movies where someone has to get out in front of the car in the rain and he's cranking up the engine. And I don't know when this ended, maybe around World War I, thereabouts. Now, imagine the position of a company that introduces the self-starter. It alone has the self-starter. What's going to be the effect on its market share, its profit margin, and rate of profit? Okay, it's going to be very high. This will be an extremely profitable technology, circa 1910. Okay, but now this company is doing very, very well. What is the effect on the sales and profits of the other automobile companies that don't have this improvement? They're down. So here we have a significant inequality in profits within the same industry. What do you think will be the response of the other firms in the auto industry just as fast as they can? To duplicate as soon as they possibly can. And once they do, once something like the self-starter becomes the general standard of the industry, once everybody's got a self-starter, can any special profit any longer be made from it? No. Then the rate of profit is brought back down. The low rates of profit of those who hadn't had the innovation, as soon as they match it, their low rate of profit will be restored to the normal level. The premium profit will be brought down. Now, if you see, notice you have high profits from innovation. There are high profits from innovation. If you introduce an improved product, that's the source of high profits, so long as it's not the general standard of the industry, so long as you're alone in doing it or you don't have too many others duplicating it yet. Similarly, if you can produce your product at a lower cost of production and charge the same price as the others, but your costs are lower, you'll have a premium rate of profit too. But again, what will the others do as soon as they learn of your premium profit? what would they be attempting to do? Duplicate your cost-cutting efficiency. And once they have, what will you be able to earn a premium profit on the basis of that cost cut? Now, you can see this over and over again. There was a time in the 19th century when some firms, I guess notably Carnegie Steel, the predecessor of United States Steel, I believe they were the first in the United States to introduce the Bessemer process of steel making, which represented a major improvement in efficiency, a major reduction in cost, and they profited very, very handsomely. How long has it been since any steel firm has been able to profit because it uses the Bessemer process, if anyone still does, if that hasn't been entirely superseded by still more efficient methods? Okay, so no one can profit from that. No one profits because their automobiles have the self-starter. No one is profiting because their trousers come with zippers. There are all kinds of things that in their day were the source of special profits but have long since ceased to be. The premium profits attached to improvements in products, so long as they're not yet the general standard, and more efficient methods, so long as they're not yet the general standard. But once they become the general standard, those premium profits are eliminated. Well, what do you have to do if you want to maintain a premium rate of profit over a long period of time? Yes, Mr. Feldman. Well, you can have patent protection, and that will extend your profitability for some time. But if you wanted to have a premium profit after the patent expires, you have to have further innovation. You see, any innovation can be profitable for a limited period, even with a patent. But then the special profit, once the technology is known and others are able to duplicate it, the special profit is eliminated. You can go on earning a special profit, but then what's required is further innovation. And I think perhaps the best example of this of all, right from our own time, is Intel. 20 years ago, the hottest thing in computing was the 8286 chip. And Intel was in the forefront of producing that, and then they made very good profits off the 8286. Well, how long could those profits last once others like AMD and whoever else was in the industry, once they're producing the 286 also, is the 286 any longer especially profitable? So what did Intel have to do to maintain its profitability? The 386. And then the same story. And now the latest is the Pentium 4. Now, notice the high profits last only so long as you're in the forefront or early in the process of innovation. And if you stop, if you fail to continue to innovate, your premium profits will be eliminated. And if you stop innovating and others continue, then what happens to you? You pass by, and if you do not catch up to them fairly fast, where do you end up? You'll be out of business. You'll be driven out of business. Merely to remain in business at all, you have to adopt innovations. It's just a question of how soon. You may not be the very first, but you'll have to adopt the innovations of the leaders as soon as you can, so as not to be passed by too great a margin, or you'll be driven out of business. So a major aspect of business activity is continuous improvement. Yes, Mr. Feldman.
You know, just a good example, I would think of the Kodak.
Yeah.
They had led the market early on with photography and things of that nature.
Yeah, Kodak. Now Kodak has had to abandon ordinary film developing because others are doing it more efficiently. There was a Polaroid. Polaroid was a major innovator after World War II, these self-developing pictures. And now that process has been made obsolete by digital photography. And they didn't catch up quickly enough, nor Kodak. So no one is safe permanently. Any firm, however big, however wonderful its past accomplishments have been, it can end up going out of business if it does not continue to be a leader in innovation and others start to get too great an advantage over it. So no one's status is secure indefinitely. There was a question over here, Mr. Okay. All right, now, if we look at this a little bit further, there's a premium profit when an innovation comes on, but then the premium profit is eliminated through competition. And to continue a premium profit, you need further innovation. Okay, we've established that. What does this imply about who is ending up pocketing in the long run, who is gaining the benefit of all these innovations?
Public.
The consumer, the general consuming public. The general consuming public is getting progressively better products at lower and lower prices. The public is ending up with better and better products at lower and lower prices. Now, there are a number of things to say. I make a point here how the concern with profits expands production in the economy. Now, insofar as profit is the incentive to introduce new, improved products, if it's the incentive to replace the wooden plow with the iron plow with the steel plow, the horse-drawn steel plow with a tractor-drawn steel plow, and on and on and on, well, from such examples, you can see how the profit motive is operating to expand production, improve production. But I want to develop the implications just of the quest to cut costs, how cost-cutting operates to expand production in the economic system as a whole. The more we can reduce the cost of producing any particular item, the more, whether we are aware of it or not, the more we're tending to increase the ability to produce in the economy as a whole. Now, what is one very major, not the only way, but perhaps the most prominent way of cutting costs? Pardon me?
Reducing labor.
Yeah, labor-saving improvements. Labor-saving improvements. That underlay practically all machinery produced using less labor. All right, well, what is the connection between producing any given product, any given quantity of a given product, with less labor? How can we connect that to increasing production in the economy as a whole?
Frees up labor for other
focuses. Yeah, labor is released, and it didn't die off. It's there, available to produce. So whatever it had been producing, we now continue to produce that using fewer people, and the people we no longer need, they're available to produce more of something else, or maybe even more of that same thing, but more of something. So to the extent that we attempt and succeed in producing each given thing with less labor, we're making the labor available to produce more of other things. Now, yes, Mr. Levy?
At this point, would you argue that another ancillary benefit is the fact that as you have more sophisticated and more efficient production processes, you're also elevating the education level of the workforce, so that sophistication that's going with the product is trickling down the sophistication level of the workforce?
Would I argue, if I understand the question correctly, that a side effect of this process of improved products and methods of production is that the labor force becomes more improved, that reaches a higher level? I'd say there's an indirect connection. It's not because of what's required in the productive process itself. Sometimes people think that since production methods are getting more sophisticated, you need to have more education to keep up with this. I don't think that this progress is raising the level of intellectual demands, perhaps the opposite. Just think what can be accomplished using computers, or just think of, you go into McDonald's and you buy something and you need change. Do you think many of the people giving you change would even know how to calculate the correct change if they didn't have that simple machine that they plug in how much you've given them, what the cost of the thing was, and it calculates what the change is? So you're going to have people giving correct change, whom I doubt many of whom would know how to do that mentally or even with pen and paper. Similarly, you have because of computers, high school graduates, I understand, using computers are routinely able to solve mathematical problems that not too many years ago required PhDs in mathematics to solve. Think of furniture making machinery. Furniture making machinery permitted people to accomplish results comparable to what had previously required skilled cabinet makers. And now you could have just semi-skilled workers using furniture making machinery accomplishing results that used to require skilled cabinet makers. So I'd say the actual effect of our improvements is typically to lower the human skill level required to accomplish a given set of results, to make it easier for people with any given skill set to accomplish greater results. But nevertheless, there is a tie to higher levels of intellectual achievement. And I think the connection there is that to the extent we adopt the improved products and methods of production, what's the effect on the general standard of living and the time available for leisure?
The first, I'd say that it's increased. The second, I'm not so sure about, because California is the perfect example. You have an incredibly high standard of living, and everybody has a level of stress and busyness still left out that I think is unprecedented.
Okay, we have a very high standard of living. A lot of people are stressed. But in terms of the time available that you don't need to spend at a paying job, what do you think is the general effect? It's more free time, isn't it? Now, what people do with the free time is another issue. But they do a byproduct of a higher productivity of labor is that people don't need as many hours to produce more than they used to have with more hours. Now, between the higher standard of living and greater leisure, I would say that's the foundation of the population having a higher level of education and being generally more sophisticated. If you think about it, thanks to these various improvements, the average worker in any first world country is able to have a first class library in his own apartment or home in paperback. You could buy any of the great books of philosophy or science if he has an interest in them. They're affordable. You can have a music collection that is very impressive, reprints of works of art. So this is working in the direction of a rise in the intellectual level. And then there are other things which I don't think are necessary, but are present and are working in the opposite direction, and that's the state of contemporary education. So we should be having a society where the general level of knowledge is getting higher and higher, but I don't think we can observe that. It's not the fault of the economic system. The economic system is laying the foundation for greater knowledge and education, but the educational system isn't working right. All right, well now, going further with cost cuts, the most prominent method is labor-saving machinery. But also, notice, when you can substitute a comparably good but less expensive material, that's a way of cutting costs. How does that often translate into a saving of labor, and thus the release of labor to expand the production of other things? Yeah, if you can replace a more expensive material with an equally good, less expensive material, why would that likely be an indirect way of saving labor?
Less people to produce that type of material.
So less labor to produce the material. Why is the material less expensive? Well, a likely explanation, or a good part of the explanation, is that the less expensive material requires less labor in its production than does the more expensive material. So, to that extent, shifting to equally good but less expensive materials would save labor also. Now, ultimately, I think cost savings translate into either labor savings or making it possible for labor of lesser skill to accomplish what used to require labor of greater skill, and sometimes making it possible for less valued materials that whose value was determined not by the quantity of labor, but by their own scarcity. We can have different materials, the value of which is determined on the basis of the limitation of their supply at any given time, together with the demand. And sometimes we can substitute a less expensive one for a more expensive one. And we'll see that that's analogous to substituting less skilled labor for more skilled labor. Why should we expect that being able to produce something using less skilled labor instead of more skilled labor should make a contribution to increasing overall production? Why? Yes? I'm sorry?
Less skilled labor is cheaper.
Less skilled labor is cheaper, and that's why we'd want to do it as far as we can. But why should we expect that that would translate into an enhancement in our overall ability to produce in the economic system?
The higher skilled workers can do higher skilled
level
things.
Yeah, isn't it equivalent? If we can make it possible for people of lower skill to achieve the same sort of results that used to require only people of greater skill, isn't that essentially similar to having more skilled people? If we can enable people with IQs of 100 to accomplish what used to require an IQ of 120, isn't that comparable to having more people with IQs of 120, at least to this extent? Okay, well, what do you think the effect of a more intelligent population on the ability to produce must be in the nature of the case? We should be able to produce more. What we do is, when we substitute less skilled labor for more skilled, make it possible for it to produce the same kind of results because we're using better machinery or something of that kind, that is equivalent to having a larger supply of skilled labor available. We'll have more skilled labor available for other things. And even if it were the case that some of the skilled workers who had a given skill that's being made obsolete, even if they couldn't learn another skill, what will be true of their successors? Imagine even if it were the case that someone who's 50 years old and whose skill is made obsolete, even though at one time he had the ability to acquire skills, now he's lost it through rust, mental rust. But his place is going to be taken by somebody else of comparable ability, and where will that other person go? Not the same place. He'll be available for some higher skilled job somewhere else. So this, if we think of furniture making machinery, if we don't need people, as many people with the level of skill of skilled cabinet makers to produce furniture, well then there are people who would have had that potential who don't go along that path. They apply their same basic level of ability to learning some other skill set. And we have a larger supply of skills available for somewhere else. Yes, Mr. Feldman.
I just was curious to get your position on the big argument of us sending a lot of jobs overseas for less cost on the labor.
Yeah.
Is that hurting us or helping us? Because there's kind of two trains of thought there.
Yeah.
If they don't send them, some of these companies can't compete on the local level.
Yeah.
So they're going to lose jobs because they're going to go out of business for the people that are here.
Yeah.
Same time, you know, the whole other side is
where we're
getting rid of our jobs.
Yeah. Okay, now you see, it's true that there are certain jobs that have been done here that will cease being done here and will be done abroad. But isn't that true with any kind of free trade? We are producing something domestically, and now instead of producing it domestically, we import it. And so the people producing that thing are no longer within our borders, they're outside the country. But does this mean that free trade causes unemployment? What happened to the people who used to produce the goods for the domestic market, who now no longer produce the goods for the domestic market because we're importing those goods? Well, they will produce something else. And I would say a way to analyze the job export issue, the outsourcing of jobs, suppose you start with the example. Here's an American programmer. He's getting $100,000 a year, and the same level of programming can be done in India for $20,000 a year. Okay. Now, why does the American programmer refuse to accept $20,000 a year and be competitive with the Indian program? Well, is it just that he doesn't like that level of living, or that there is some much better alternative available to him that he's almost certain to find within not too long a time? There's a better alternative. He doesn't have to go to $20,000. He may have to take a cut. He won't be earning $100,000 anymore, but he's almost certainly not going to have to earn as little as his Indian replacement. He might have to earn $60,000 or $70,000, which is not very nice for someone used to $100,000. But notice the point is that his income will not fall to the same degree as the reduction in cost of doing what he's doing. Now, suppose we generalize this. Suppose we think of the economy as consisting of 100 different jobs, however many different jobs there are. And suppose we start thinking of outsourcing everything. We can outsource every type of job and accomplish it at a fraction of the present cost. But the people who are doing the present jobs will not have to take reductions equivalent to the reductions in cost. Suppose the general case were the American begins with an income level of 100. His foreign competitor has an income level of 20. The American doesn't have to come down to 20. He comes down to 60. All right, what would be the effect on the cost of producing all the goods that we previously were buying and in which Americans are no longer working? To what level of cost will they correspond?
To 20.
Well, now, if you're earning 60, but the prices that you have to pay are governed by costs corresponding to 20, how does that affect you?
Does that happen?
Well, yeah, because, you see, the cost cuts in the principle of the thing, the cost cuts are greater than the income cuts. And we have to recognize that if you have widespread general cost cuts, they're going to show up in comparable price cuts.
But in general, does that make its way to the market for the most part, or does it make its way to the return of the ROE?
Rate of return.
Right.
Okay, now let's imagine that we started out, companies are cutting their costs to a fraction, and somehow this is all going right into profit. Well, then the key question is, what are they doing with the profits? Now, see, a question that we won't get into in this term, I go into it heavily in macro. If anyone were really interested, I would refer them to chapter 16 in capitalism. What's governing the average rate of profit in the economy as a whole in the long run? There has to be, it's the extent to which the amount of money spent to buy the products in the economy exceeds the amount of money spent to buy the means of producing the products. So if we had a situation where the total product of the whole economy were sold every year for 1,000 units of money, each unit of money representing however many billions of dollars, if the whole sales revenue of the economy could be conceived of as 1,000, but year in and year out, 900 were being spent for the means of production, what do you think this would imply about the total costs deducted from the sales revenue of 1,000? Pardon me? The total amount of costs. If 900 is spent year in and year out to produce the products, which are sold for 1,000, what should we expect to be the magnitude of the costs deducted from the 1,000? Pardon me? 900, 90%. So what should be profits? 10%. So this sort of thing, when you have reductions in unit cost, will not show up, at least not lastingly, as increases in the rate of profit. They'll show up as a larger volume of means of production purchased, a larger volume of output produced. So if you ask, must this flow through to the market? When you have cost savings, if the ratio of expenditure for means of production to the sales revenues, if that remained the same, it must flow through to the market. It can't be retained as higher profits for long. So, and this is why when we do have cost cuts, you can rely on it flowing through to the market. And a way to see this, a related aspect, I suspect I might have given you this example earlier. Imagine Gillette Razor Company figures out a way to produce their razor blades at a sharply lower cost, and they get a patent on it. Okay, so here they are, they're charging, they might charge the same price. They might decide, we're not going to sell many more razor blades if we cut the price, so we'll keep the price the same, and we'll make higher profits by cutting the costs. Well, the key question is, what are they doing with those profits? To the extent they save and reinvest them and put them into some other line of production, what will be the effect on production and supply somewhere else in the economy? It will increase. And to find buyers, what will have to happen to prices elsewhere in the economy?
Decrease.
They'll have to decrease. So you might have a situation, there's a cost cut in one industry, it doesn't flow through right away because there's patent protection, or maybe other people just can't figure out how to do it. But if the profits are saved and reinvested, they're going to operate to expand production somewhere else and bring down prices somewhere else. And then ultimately they'll bring down prices back in this line as soon as the technology becomes known or the patent comes off.
So earlier you said in a sort of related to that comment that those profits eventually come back out into the economy. And is that again because of that uniformity of profit crunching?
Well, this goes to something related to the determination of where the rate of profit becomes uniform. See, we'd have the uniformity of profit principle in one state of affairs operating to equalize the rate of profit at 10% in a different state of affairs, at 20% in another, at 5%. So what I was talking about in the last few minutes pertains to what's governing the level at which the rate tends to equalize.
Because each time you say that uniformity of profit, you explain it in my mind, I keep like silently saying within a relevant range. Is that...
Well, if you want to...
I think it's too generalized, because there's certain... Not every industry has the same uniformity.
No, at any given time, there'll be a huge spread.
Yeah.
And even on a permanent basis, if there are some things that are especially risky or highly disfavored, that would have a premium profit to compensate for the other negatives. And you see, in order for a uniform rate of profit to be achieved, plus or minus whatever premiums and discounts there have to be, you'd have to have the basic data of the system being unchanged. You'd have to stop innovation. People would have to maintain the same set of tastes and preferences so that everything fundamental could remain the same. Then it would work out toward that. Okay, now I want to call your attention to something. I've maintained that because of the incentives to cutting costs, we should expect prices to fall, that things should be getting not only better as time goes on, but cheaper. Now, in a few cases, we can actually observe that, notably computers. And I had a personal confirmation today, in a way. I bought a 250-gigabyte internal hard drive for about $200. Now, think of that. That's 80 cents a gigabyte. 20 years ago, I paid $2,500 for 40 megabytes. Now, think of what a reduction in cost per megabyte this is, and similarly with RAM and so on. So in computers, you certainly see an incredible reduction in prices per unit of storage, of megahertz or whatever, RAM, random access memory. But we don't see that in many other cases. Usually, we're seeing prices rise. Well, is this a contradiction? Is the implication of the uniformity of profit principle that you make high profits by cutting costs, then competitors duplicate your advance, that brings the price of the product down, then you need to cut costs further? That would imply that prices should be getting cheaper and cheaper, pretty much across the board, just at uneven rates. But what we see far more often, certainly in the last, for most of the last 100 years, is prices rising from year to year. Well, can anyone reconcile the implications of a principle, which I'm saying is really a solid and true principle, with our observation of prices actually rising for the most part in most years.
Inflation.
All right, inflation, yes, Mr. Trexler?
Well, I think there's just an increased demand period that the population growth, the markets are expanding.
Okay. Now we have an expansion in demand for everything, and Miss, I'm awfully sorry, I don't know how to pronounce your name properly. Wei?
Wei.
Okay, thank you. Miss Wei refers to inflation. What do you mean by inflation, Miss Wei?
Is inflation that because more money gets pumped into the economy, things are, there's more capital than people in the economy's cost items to be higher,
okay. If by inflation you mean you're referring to more money being pumped in,
yeah.
That's essentially it. Not every last increase in the quantity of money, but certainly increases at an undue rate. And you could take as a rough guide to the standard below which it's not undue and above which it is undue. I think you could take the rate of increase in a gold money. There would be some rate of increase, and inflation is the rate of increase in the quantity of money over and above that. Perhaps the rate of, an increase in the quantity of money greater than, say, 2% a year. And that would be the essence of inflation. And what is the effect of new and additional money on people's ability to spend? That increase it, and so that's what operates to raise the demand for everything. It's not more population. Suppose we didn't have an increase in the quantity of money, but we had more population. And now that means there's more people out there seeking jobs. What's the effect of a larger number of job seekers in the face of the same demand? What would be the effect on wage rates? Wage rates would be going down, but what will allow more people to be employed at the same wage rates, or an even higher wage rates, is an increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. Well, we actually have two processes going on at the same time. On the one side, profit-seeking businessmen are introducing ever better products and ever more efficient methods of production, which are operating to increase the production and supply of everything and operating to bring prices down. That's the effect coming from the side of business. Then we have another process coming from the side of the government, which issues the money supply, and they are issuing a larger quantity of money each year at a rate more rapid than the increase in the supply of gold, and at a rate more rapid than businessmen are able to increase the production and supply of ordinary commodities. Yes, Mrs. Zink.
So are you saying that it is necessary to increase the money supply periodically, but that has got to be within a certain balance?
Am I saying that it is necessary to increase the money supply periodically, but it has to be within a certain bounds? What I would say is that in a free market, there would almost certainly be some increase in the quantity of money. I hesitate to say that it's necessary to have a certain rate of increase. Conceivably, and there are some economists who have argued that we could have a functioning economy with no increase in the money supply. I don't think that would come up under a gold standard, but that's their position. And if so, prices would fall the more rapidly. Now, what we have is, if you put everything together, and you think of people in your own company, you think of you yourself. How many hours do you spend in connection with your job? And how often are you putting in hours above 40 hours a week? And what kind of hours are put in by people playing a really key role in your company? I think it's very, very common that businessmen are staying up late into the night, and their engineers and scientists and so on, doing as much as they can to improve production and make it more efficient. And if you put it all together across the whole spectrum of the economy, maybe in a good year, between them all, they could succeed in increasing the overall production and supply of goods 3%, 4% in a year. That would be high. And that's working as hard as they can, as conscientiously and efficiently as they can. Okay, how difficult is it to increase the quantity of this paper money 3 or 4% a year, or twice that rate? How difficult is it to expand the supply of this? What does this depend on? Do we need people discovering new processes of ink production, new processes of printing paper? What do you need to manufacture more of this stuff? Do you need the presses, the paper, and is there a shortage of any of this? Is there a scarcity of any of this? Okay, so, and also, what is the cost of producing a dollar bill or a $100 bill? It's just innocent. It's inconsequential, less than a penny a piece, I'm sure. All right, so imagine for a moment that paper money were subject to freedom of competition. And here we are, we start out, the cost of production of a dollar bill or a $100 bill is a penny, let's assume. But what's the initial buying power? Well, a dollar or $100. What kind of implied rate of profit is there? What kind of profit margin is there? If you have something, if you have a product that you can view as $100 and the cost of production as a penny, isn't this the most profitable, the highest profit margin industry in the world? And the rate of return would be incredibly high. All right, what would happen if this were open to free competition? So that if you could have a good likeness of Washington and Grant and so forth, and get the right paper and the right ink, you could be in business. What does the uniformity of profit principle imply about the rate of profit to be made in the production of paper money if it were subject to free competition? That would be reduced to the general level. This would mean that the cost of producing a dollar bill would approach a dollar bill. The cost of producing a $100 bill would approach $100. That's what would happen under free competition. And what do you think would happen to the value of the money? Would such a thing even be used as money? Just think, today you go into a supermarket, you have a few bills in your wallet, they come out with a shopping cart full of bills. So you're happy to do it that way. What if you had to go into the supermarket with a shopping cart full of money and come out with a wallet full of goods? Do you think such a money would remain as money? Would be dumped in the sewers. This has happened to some monies in the course of history. It happened to the German mark in 1923. I think it happened to the Hungarian florin around the same period of time. That happened in the 1790s to the French assignats. That happened in nationalist China in 1948. So prices in such a money would be in the millions or billions. And if you think about it, if you look at other things of comparable cost, the cost of producing a dollar bill or a $100 bill is really not significantly different than the cost of producing a paper clip or a rubber band. Suppose you were calculating prices of automobiles in terms of paper clips. And say you can buy 100 paper clips for a dollar. Well, how many paper clips would it cost you to buy a $25,000 automobile? Well, you'd have to multiply 100 times 25,000. That's 2.5 million paper clips is the paper clip price of a new medium-priced automobile. Why should we expect the price in dollars to be permanently different if they have a comparable cost of production and nothing physical limits the production? That shouldn't be a big shock. Well, what does limit the production of dollars is it's not open to free competition. It's a monopoly privilege of the government. And so it's not increased in quantity overnight to the point of destroying its value. But what does the government do each year? What do you think happens to the quantity of money from one year to the next? It's increased. Now, the government is not immune to the kinds of pressures that have an effect on ordinary people. The government knows that it costs it virtually nothing to produce additional money. Does it have any need for additional money? Aren't there all kinds of people with their hands out to the government saying, give me money for all sorts of programs? Now, if the government were not to resort to creating money, if they couldn't create money, where would it have to get the money to satisfy the demands of the people who want something from it? They'd have to impose additional taxes. Well, that is not, that would not be a popular arrangement. Just think how hard it is. The government can buy votes by giving people money. That's what it amounts to. The president introduced this prescription drug benefit. Do you think the votes of elderly citizens played no consideration, played no role? Well, that's a program that he's hoping will attract some votes to his party. Now, suppose in doing that, he said, yes, here I'm offering the new prescription drug benefit, and at the same time, I'm raising taxes to pay for it. Well, he might have some votes of some elderly people, but what about the people who'd have to pay the higher taxes? That wouldn't be very popular. But if the government has the ability to expand its expenditures without raising taxes, and what is it that enables it to do that? Well, it's got the ability to print money. So the expenditures are not closely tied to taxes. So the government yields to such pressures. They're not doing it to such an extent that the value of money is utterly destroyed in a short time. But from year to year, they are increasing the quantity of money at a rate more rapid than the increase in the production and supply of goods. And to the extent that there is this difference, what happens to prices? They go up. So the way to think of how prices are rising, while the uniformity of profit principle implies they should be falling, well, we're expressing prices in terms of something that is getting cheaper faster than most goods. You see, it is true, the uniformity of profit principle is out there working to make practically all goods cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But the value of the money is cheapening faster than the value of the goods. Let me give you this illustration of the idea, then we'll take our break. Back around 1970, pocket calculators first came out. And a new pocket calculator at that time, a pretty primitive thing, was selling for about $400. VCRs were also appearing at around the same time, and a new VCR at that time was selling for around $2,400. All right, suppose you wanted to express the price of a VCR in terms of pocket calculators. How many $400 pocket calculators would be required to equal one $2,400 VCR?
Six.
Six. Okay, now, what has subsequently happened to the price of both? They have both certainly dropped, but I don't think they've dropped to quite the same degree. Now, let us assume that the price of a new VCR is today $200. Maybe it's actually cheaper, but make the assumption that it's $200. And the price of a comparable pocket calculator to one that used to cost $400 is now $10. Now notice, VCRs used to be six pocket calculators. Now how many pocket calculators at $10 per pocket calculator would be required to buy one VCR at $200?
20.
Okay, what's happened to the pocket calculator price of the VCR? It's gone from 6 to 20, right? So in terms of pocket calculators, the price of VCRs has risen. But what has happened to the price of both expressed in ordinary money? It's both have sharply dropped, but if we express the price of the one in terms of something whose own price has fallen even more, fallen from $400 to $10, while the other has fallen from $2,400 to $200, where we have this inequality in the rate of fall, if we express the price of the one that has fallen less in terms of the one that's fallen more, what has happened to the price expressed that way? It's gone up. It's gone from 6 to 20. Well, that's the way to understand the rise in prices. It is true that the uniformity of profit principle is out there working, for the reasons I've explained, to bring down the price of virtually everything. But we're expressing prices in terms of a unit, the paper money, that is getting cheaper faster. The paper money is in the position of the pocket calculators. The ordinary goods and services are in the position of the VCRs. So the profit motive is driving down the price of the VCRs, but if we express them in paper money, the value of which has declined even further, prices have risen. And prices would, as I've explained, be in the millions and billions if we had free competition in paper money. So the fact that we observe prices rising, while our principle implies they should be falling, there is no contradiction. They are reconcilable when you realize that what explains it is that the value of paper money has declined more than the profit motive has reduced the cost and price of ordinary commodities. Okay, let's take our break here, and I hope this has sunk in, that you're following it. If you have any problems with it, please raise questions on it when we return from the break, okay?